Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is Stanford Law Professor and co-director of the school's Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, Pam Carlin. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, ZBiotics, Beam and Real Paper, and our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. James, we have probably a week's worth of stories that we could discuss today. Special counsel clears Biden of criminally hiding classified documents, as Trump did, but after interviewing him, painted a picture of a doddering old man with memory lapses. House Republicans, in a blatantly partisan act, narrowly voted to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, even though they couldn't find any high crimes or misdemeanors. And Donald Trump said that he'd encourage his pal Vladimir Putin to attack any NATO country whose defense budget wasn't sufficiently big enough. But first, the closely watched special congressional election in New York's Long Island district. Democrat Tom Suozzi won a decisive victory, not a close victory, at least 8 points, a pickup that further narrows the GOP's margin in the House. You know, it's important. This is a sort of suburban swing districts that's critical in November. And Suozzi has a pretty effective message: tough on immigration and crime, huge emphasis on abortion, and attack the right-wing Republican crazies in the House. This may be a model for Democrats in close contests. But also, James, as you have pointed out innumerable times, it continues the Democratic win streak in special elections. They also won a state legislative seat in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. James, did you feel a little sense of relief after the last couple of weeks when the New York 3 results rolled in?
Yeah, I mean, I did, to be honest with you. We had a much stronger candidate, and he did something that was smart. He never got sucked in by the left, ever. He stayed anti-crime, you know, stayed where you should be on migration. He was for orderly, legal immigration. They had a very poor candidate, to say the least. But having said that, 8 points was pretty good. And they thought they had a real shot. I think at some point we thought they might have had a real shot.
They had won every election in Long Island, Nassau County, Suffolk County, since 2020.
Well, we ran somebody with a background that helped. And let me tell you, they were running this stuff. The New York Post was running this stuff every day, front page, everything they could do. And, you know, people said, well, the abortion stuff won't matter as much in New York State because people don't feel as threatened by it, so it won't have the same saliency. And then people say, well, it's a special election. Don't read too much from it. Well, can I read something from like 15 special elections in a row that we won? Now, I don't know what it is, but clearly people don't want to vote for Republicans. That's clear. Now, whether they want to vote for Biden or how that translates into the presidential race is quite another story. But what is abundantly clear over any number of elections, and they said, well, the Republicans don't come out in the special elections. Well, that used to not be the case. It used to be the case we would lose them because they would come out. And so that speak something also to American politics. But it was a leave. Jim Gerstein, I sent it to you right away. He texted me before the polls closed. I guess he knew something on turnout models that he thought we'd win by four. I'll give Jim credit. What he meant to say would be 4 over 50.
Hey, one of the great pollsters in America and a fabulous guest on this show, and a
And a great man and a great guy.
He really is. Did a great job up in that race. And you're right. It was the right message. Tough on immigration and crime. Huge emphasis on abortion and go after the Republican crazies. That's something that should sell in most districts in America. So let's see if they pick up on it. James, let me turn to the crazies. the Mayorkas impeachment. No grounds. And it was after the House crazies rejected a bipartisan immigration bill that actually would have done something about illegal entries. But they did that at the orders of Donald Trump. But it really showed how unserious these clowns are. Even a few strong conservatives like Wisconsin's Mike Gallagher, who's widely considered to be a rising star in the party. I didn't agree with him on much, but most conservatives you talk to said Mike Gallagher's a guy to watch. The Wisconsin Democrats did not want him to run for the Senate. So now he's quitting. He's leaving. The clown show is too much. And it really is. It has to catch up with him at some point, James.
Well, I suspect the reason he's leaving is he couldn't win a primary. And Adam Kinzinger, yeah. Great guy, yeah. He left because he wasn't going to win. Liz Cheney, well, she's a great person. She stayed. She lost by 50 points. We talk about the Republican Party is doing exactly what its voters want it to do. It really does. And it's so hard to digest all of this. And Mike Johnson, you know, I used to detested him. He's now become some kind of a pathetic character. It's just hard to realize how impossible a job they put their people in. And I don't think they're going to get rid of him because I don't think there's anywhere else he can go.
No, I think you're right. If you look at that House caucus right now, it is Republican caucus. There's sort of five types, if you will. The weirdos, Mike Johnson is one. I mean, he's a homophobe and, you know, watches porno with his sons.
Homophobe.
Yes, totally obsessed. There are, secondly, the guys that are just dumb, like Jim Comer, whose IQ probably isn't room temperature. Thirdly, there's the thugs, like Jim Jordan, who covered up a sex scandal in the Ohio State wrestling team, still is getting away with it. It's outrageous. And then there are the cowards, like the timid 20. And we'll see if they pay a price. Tom Keene's son in New Jersey, or those New York lawmakers, they knew the Mayorkas thing was a total fraud, but they were afraid to cross the great Don. And so we'll see what happens. But it really is, it's the craziest group of House members that I have ever seen. And I've been around this town for a long time.
Yes, they're crazy because their voters demand that they be crazy. Listen to me, people. What they're doing is democracy in action. I don't think some of them are really crazy, but if you went in there and you weren't crazy and you wanted to be renominated by your party, you better get crazy and you better get crazy.
You think you got crazy pills? I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene maybe could take some of those Jewish laser beams and, you know, and turn them into pills to make you crazier. But it's a hell of a collection.
Yeah. I think she's genuinely crazy. I wish some insider would separate the Republicans into those that are genuinely crazy and those that are acting crazy to get renominated. I mean, we know the obvious ones that are genuinely crazy, but I suspect a lot of them are not. But it doesn't matter. So when you vote on something like this, there's no record. It's just you vote to impeach. Your reason does not matter, nor should it. And of course, you're doing something that you know better. But you say, well, what would be better? If I don't vote to impeach him, I won't get the nomination. The Democrat will win the seat. And then that means that the communists take over.
Right.
Or some
right.
rationale comes in. There's a rationale behind all of this. So in order to stop the communists, all right, we have to appease the crazies. That's the price of fighting communism. That's how tortured the whole fucking logic is.
James, you got to go to a theme park in Havana to find a communist these days. They don't exist, but they have to exist in their minds. You're absolutely right. And of course, it's their voters and it's their leader, you know, the commandant. Trump. They're petrified of having him attack them. I mean, the worst thing, the four-time indicted Trump did was to sabotage NATO, an alliance, challenges that have served the collective interest of Western Europe and of America for 75 years. Has some challenges, but it protected us from Russian invasions, as they did in Ukraine, which is not a NATO member. But Putin actually is much closer to Trump's authoritarianism, or Trump's authoritarianism is much closer to Putin than democratic elected governments in Germany or Lithuania or Finland. So what he's trying to do in sabotaging this Ukraine bill that the Senate passed, 70-29, almost half the Republicans. And let's give Mitch McConnell a lot of credit on this. And now your boy from Louisiana, Mike Johnson, is hiding behind the covers. He's so scared and doesn't even want to bring it up.
Well, I think, first of all, as I saw along, and I'll repeat it, I actually think there is a PT. I do. But absent that, there's horribly incriminating evidence that Putin has over Trump. And, of course, his total control on the Republican Party makes this possible. So now he kicks out Rona McDaniel. It's a kind of pathetic, weak figure. And is putting large Trump there. Now, why would Trump be doing that? Anytime you have any question about Trump, the answer is money. Because Rona McDaniel, for all of her flaws, had this quaint idea that the purpose of the Republican National Committee was to help Republican candidates get elected. So she wanted to put the money in campaigns. And Trump, of course, wants the money in his legal defense fund. So goodbye, Rona. Hello, Laura. It's right in front of you. You know what the rank-and-file Republican's going to say? Fine. I'll send more money to this criminal. I'll send more money so he can steal from me. You know, if he said, you know, what is a field of dreams? If you ask for it, they'll give it to you. And you can tell him that he's stealing it, that he's not using it for the intended purposes, that he's putting the money in his pocket, that he's paying his incompetent buffoon lawyers. And you know what they'll do? They'll send more money. Because the problem is not Republican politicians. The problem is Republican voters. And they're utter fools. There's nothing you can do to change their mind. You can do like we did in New York 3. We can nominate sane candidates who hadn't fallen into left-wing stupidity, and who are willing to contrast themselves as good, you know, favoring good, progressive, common sense policies, and we could win some elections. But it's all about their voters and what they want, and it's very clear. And the terrible 20, or the timid 20, and the other two, they can't do anything. They're caught. Yeah. They're stuck. It must be some hell to live in as a politician, that you have to act crazy and you have to justify your craziness under some convoluted logic that by submitting to the MAGA madness, you're stopping the return of Lenin, Trotsky. I don't know if something. I have no idea. But
James,
that's
can they use some of that RNC money to have a concert for what's her name, Laura Trump? You ever heard her sing?
I did. I was treated to that this morning, and I was going through there. And I have to say, my daughters, the few times I've been stupid enough or drunk enough to try to sing, they said, "Daddy, your voice sounds like Goose Boys." It's a probably good way to describe her voice. Goose part.
My wife won't let me sing in church. That's how bad I am. But, you know, she's right up there.
I've never been to church that drunk.
Bad things happened to the Republicans, New York 3 and the silly impeachment of Mayorkas. It wasn't silly. It was disgraceful. What Mike Johnson's doing. But it was a bad week for Biden, too. The special counsel, Robert Hur, I think it is, cleared him of any criminal acts or intent in taking classified documents after he was vice president. It was he was careless, in contrast to Trump's deliberate, deceitful taking and then lying. So there's a huge difference between these two cases, which Hur did make clear. But Hur's a movement conservative, Federalist Society lawyer, and he sought to protect his right-wing credentials by gratuitously declaring that Biden was an old man with a faulty memory. Then, that was bad, then the president compounded the problem by having a press conference to deny he was an old man with a faulty memory and then confuse Mexico and Egypt. I mean, James, it reminded me of a story almost 50 years ago. There was a magazine called The New Times, had a circulation of about 11. I mean, 11, just, you know, pure 11. And they wrote a piece saying that Bill Scott, was the senator from Virginia, was the dumbest person in the United States Senate. And then what he did, he called a press conference the next day to deny he was that dumb. It was on the front page of The Washington Post and every Virginia paper. Why in the hell Biden had that press conference, I will never know. Biden is not dumb. And I think he's capable of governing, but he is old, and it shows it. And I am exactly his age, James, a couple weeks younger. And I am busy, you know, working with you, writing a column, teaching. But 20 years ago, I was running a big bureau, wrote a column, did a regular TV show, chair of the JFK profile and courage, on the trustee of my alma mater. I couldn't do all that today. I couldn't do all that today, and I don't have anything like, never have had one thousandth the pressure that Biden feels. So we both wish Biden had not run, but it's not an easy time addressing the age issue for him, compounded this past week. Can't go out and give a lot of interviews and town halls, as some have suggested. And the only thing is to say the choice is between an aging candidate who has had a great one term and would have been better off not running, but is, and a criminal who doesn't really believe in democracy. Now, that's an easy choice, but it's going to be tough this fall.
I'm going to defer my comments on Mr. Hur until the outrage. So, we see this Wednesday night, last Wednesday night, I guess it was. And we all watched it. And the answer is, they send a bunch of perfectly not competent Hall of Fame historians, John Malintz, Michael Beschloff, or Hall of Fame economist Paul Krugman, and said, well, I met with the president, and he seemed fine. He was responsive, and he listened to what I said, and he had follow-up questions. And why would I pay any attention to that when I can see what I see with my own fucking lying eyes? Okay, Mexico, Egypt, anybody could get that confused. The shuffling, the everything else, I don't think so. I think, you know, and I think we're probably going to go to post with this, where we are. And remember, they turned down an interview on the Super Bowl, right? So the facts are you're 3.75% down in the public averages. So, you know, I don't know, maybe it's two. And you have a shot at, it wouldn't be 123 million in that, but it'd probably be 60, 65 million people. And you can't do it. You literally can't do it. And so you missed that opportunity. And of course, that is the campaign and the people around him. I suspect his family saying, Joe, you can't do this. It's too big a risk. All right. And then they decide that they're going to do their own video. And it's just going to be on football because that was his last deal he wanted to do. They wanted to do with CBS. Don't ask me about politics or my job, but ask me football questions. And CBS, I think correctly, I know correctly, said, no, we're not going to do that. So he does his own video, of which he's in control of. And they ask him a tough question. Who's your favorite Kelsey? Travis or Jason? And of course, he says, Mom Kelsey. And they put a picture up, and Mom Kelsey is a, you know, very nice housewife from Ohio because she makes good chocolate chip cookies. I could roll out to bed laughing. I mean, that's the stuff, but that's all they can do. They don't have any other choice. That's what we're going to post with. And go to post, we will. Go to post, we will. But and somebody will come out and say, well, maybe actually he was coherent, but not supposed to be. And then you watch him on TV.
Well, I think you're right. And let's just hope that people appreciate or worry or fear more the evil alternative. Hey, James, our guest is one of the best legal minds in America, even though she's in Italy right now. Pam Carlin, Stanford Law professor, former Supreme Court clerk, former Justice Department Assistant Attorney General. There's no one better. Pam, with 4 criminal indictments, 91 counts, Trump's fate may well be in the hands of the courts. But the picture is not clear. First, Jack Smith's January 6th case, where Trump basically claims he's immune from prosecution. One man is a king. Logic, political and judicial of sorts, suggests that the Supreme Court has an obvious middle ground. Side with Trump that he cannot be disqualified from the ballots because of the insurrection, and rule that he does not have immunity. Is that too simple?
No, I don't think that's too simple at all. I mean, technically, the two cases are totally separate one from another. That is, whether he can be on the ballot and whether he can be tried for crimes he committed while he was in office. There's no necessary connection between those. But I think a lot of people are assuming that the Supreme Court is going to essentially split the baby there and allow him to be put back on the ballot, require him to be put back on the ballot, but hold that he is not immune from criminal prosecution.
Pam, if that's the case, it may be all about timing, about speed. Trump wants the court to slow walk this. He said he had a very careful deliberation on this critical question, as if he's deliberated. And that's in order that the trial won't take place before the election. How realistic is that possibility, that danger?
Well, it's a danger if the Supreme Court doesn't rule fairly quickly on the claim of absolute immunity from prosecution, because, you know, each of the trial is likely to take quite a while. I mean, it's not going to be a short case, the January 6th case. And so it realistically has to begin by sometime early in the summer to get it done before the election is decided. And I think that the other thing is, you know, the closer it gets to the election, the more he's going to argue that even if he's not entitled to absolute immunity, the courts should exercise their discretion not to have a trial in the midst of the election season.
But Pam, if the court rules, say, the end of February, early March, there's no reason they can't start that trial in April.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I don't think they can necessarily start it in April, but they can start it fairly soon thereafter. I mean, a lot of it depends on how much of the discovery that's been stayed and how much of the pretrial proceedings that have been stayed for the last month, essentially, while we have been going through this process of him seeking review in the D.C. Circuit and then the Supreme Court, how much stuff still remains to be done before the trial begins.
Let me turn to a couple of the others. The criminal charge in Atlanta seemed rather easy. They have him on tape. They have him on the telephone saying, you know, get me votes, change the election outcome. But the prosecutor, Fannie Willis, has jeopardized this, it seems, with reports of the affair she had with a man tapped to play a top role in the case. There's even an effort now to disqualify her. Whatever the merits, and I don't know them here, isn't the case certainly delayed until after the election? Maybe it would have been anyway. And at least the credibility of the prosecutor under a cloud.
Yeah, I mean, it was an incredibly bad move on the DA's part, on Ms. Willis's part, to hire somebody with whom she had this kind of relationship. Even before all of this came out, that case was not really scheduled to begin until the summer. That's a case with multiple defendants, so it has a very different kind of valence than, for example, Jack Smith's 2 cases. Each, you know, the case in Washington, which is the one that I think is more likely to go forward quickly. President Trump, former President Trump, is the only defendant, whereas the you know, the Georgia case is 19 defendants, some of whom have pleaded guilty, not clear which ones would be tried at which point. So that case was already kind of complicated. I mean, not complicated on what happened, but complicated on how you would adjudicate it, how you'd try it.
And how quickly. Yeah. The final one, I'll turn to James, is the Mar-a-Lago case, Trump taking the classified documents, it looked like, and refusing to return them and lying about it, it looked like a slam dunk. But the judge he appointed to the court, I think her name is Elaine Cannon, seems to be showing her appreciation and undercutting the case.
Yeah, she's been moving very slowly. And recently they've had a set of ex-parte meetings where we don't know exactly what happened during the meetings to try and deal with what forms of classified information the government is going to have to turn over in advance of the trial. And you've probably heard this phrase, gray mail, which is like blackmail, mm-hmm. only what it is, you know, a defendant essentially says to the government, if I'm going to trial, I'm going to reveal all this stuff you don't want revealed. And so the government feels pressured to drop the case. I don't think that's going to happen here, but I think it's going to take a good long time for Judge Cannon to rule. And then my guess is she'll rule in a way that the prosecution doesn't like, and they'll have to take that up to the 11th Circuit. And so that case, which is a very simple case on the kind of meat and bones, on the substance of the case, might be the last of these to go to trial, if it goes at all.
Yeah. James Carville?
Prof, I see, don't know, that Judge Cannon is so egregious that the 11th Circuit, maybe it's a fantasy, could replace her. Is that possible? Or is that highly unusual? Is there any chance that this could happen? Where do you come down on this question?
So it's possible, it's highly unusual, and it's hard to know whether they're going to do that or not. You know, on some cases where a court of appeals decides that a district judge has gotten stuff really wrong, they will remand the case with directions to have it reassigned to another judge so that they don't have to keep reversing a judge. You know, her last opinion that went up to the Court of Appeals in this case was just so egregious. That was when she was trying to appoint a special master and the like. You know, if she does something like that again, I would expect that there'd be some serious consideration of whether to replace her, because it just doesn't look good to have somebody slow walking a case that really needs to go to trial quickly.
So this is something that in the Mueller report famously said that he didn't have sufficient evidence to indict Trump for Russia, whatever it is, cooperation, collusion, whatever the word is. And that because he didn't, he wasn't going to comment on it, because Justice Department policy was you speak through indictments. And if you're not going to indict somebody, you stop it. Then, of course, I will talk about this in outrage. We do what Washington always wants us to do. Barry Garland, maybe, you know, the worst attorney general that I can remember, appoints her. All right, we'll talk about that in outrage. So, as I understand it, under the statute, Mr. Herr has to write a report and give the report to the attorney general.
That's correct.
Does the attorney general could he have redacted the gratuitous stuff that was in there that Mueller or other people said you shouldn't do, or that Justice Department policy was you only speak through indictments, and if you don't indict somebody, then shut up and go on with the next thing? I'm curious as to how could Garland have deleted that from the report that Herr made? Did he have to make Herr's report public, or what's going on here?
So the Justice Department, as I understand it, has a policy of making these reports public. Now, things can be redacted from them. And indeed, if I'm recalling correctly, I think a lot of stuff was redacted in the Mueller report for national security reasons. The other thing, of course, is that, again, you will remember this quite well, when Attorney General Barr released the Mueller report, he released a sort of summary of it as well that was designed to shape what the message was to the public. And that clearly could have been done here, because the real news here was that Rob Herr did not think he could get a conviction of Joe Biden, and that what Joe Biden did was materially different from what Donald Trump has done. But that all got lost because everybody was focused so much on the kind of gratuitous additional stuff. The thing it reminded me of the most in that way was a review in Field and Stream of Lady Chatterley's Lover, where they said, this is a really great book about gamekeeping on a Midlands estate, but it's just punctuated by these gratuitous sex scenes. And I kind of feel that way about the her report, that it was a, you know, it was a fairly straightforward report on, you know, Joe Biden, while he may have been somewhat careless, did not willfully engage in criminal behavior. And that just got lost due to the gratuitous discussions of how good is he on dates.
But that gratuitous discussion, as I appreciate it, is against Justice Department policy.
Yeah. You're not supposed to say things in one of these reports that somebody isn't going to get the opportunity to respond to in court if the stuff is damaging to them.
Right. Okay. And Garland chose to let it all of the dirty laundry, if you will, be aired out there. Okay. Al, back to you. Thank you.
I'm not going to defend Garland, but I think if he had excised that, the odds are about 100 to 1 that Garland and the Federalist Society would have found a way to get it out. And then
it would have been leaked by somebody.
General covering up. So anyway, it would have been there.
But I do think it would have been useful for there to be some framing.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, that says,
I agree.
This report did not find that, you know, that Joe Biden committed a crime or that his guilt could be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And as a result, we're not going to go forward with a prosecution. That was the real news. And it kind of got lost.
Pam, you're an expert on the Supreme Court. Let's go back to what, as a total observer, layperson, if you will, that my take on the court, and that is that the chief cares desperately about its reputation, and its reputation is in tatters, and that bothers him a great deal. And I don't think it bothers Alito or Thomas, you know, one iota. So when this case comes up, I think both given the law and his feelings about the court, the chief, along with the three progressives, are almost certainly going to vote against Trump on immunity. And that means that the three, hopefully like Nixon, it could be a unanimous decision. But with Alito and Thomas, I rather doubt it. So that leaves the three others, Barrett, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch. Is there any sense of how they can be sized up?
Well, I don't think they haven't done anything really that indicates yet what their thinking on this is. But again, the law just seems so straightforward. And what the D.C. Circuit, you know, the D.C. Circuit oral argument made it so clear. It just can't be the case that a president can commit blatant crimes while in office. And there's nothing to be done about that unless they both find out about the crimes while he's still in office and impeach him and convict him and remove him from office. I mean, there was this moment in the D.C. Circuit where one of the judges said, if the president told the special forces to assassinate his opponent, could anything be done about that? And, you know, Donald Trump's lawyer basically said, not unless Congress impeaches him and removes him from office. And that just can't be right.
Boy, that's horrible. One final question, I'll turn it back. New York Times had an interesting piece last Sunday by Robert Draper on Mark Meadows. Mark Meadows is sort of the mystery man here. He testified before Jack Smith's grand jury, the grand jury run by Jack Smith, for 6 hours. Now, you know, it seems to me it's not leaping very much to say if you testify for 6 hours, you're not just talking about what a great leader Donald Trump was.
Well, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, on the one hand, he might be testifying very fully. On the other hand, you know, a witness in front of the grand jury can ask after every question to leave the room and talk to his lawyer and then come back and read the formulaic, you know, on the advice of counsel, I must decline to answer that question on the grounds that my answer may tend to incriminate me. So it's hard to know for how long somebody was there, how much they say.
Right. James?
So, Prof, you've been watching this for a long time. You've been involved in this at every level. One of the things that strikes me is there can never be a Democratic special counsel. If the Republican is being investigated, well, we better put a Republican special counsel in there. If a Democrat is being investigated, well, we better put a Republican special counsel in there. And then the special counsel sends it Mueller, who's another Republican, Rod Rosenstein, who we were told, oh, he's a principal conservative. Bullshit. Total bullshit. So they sent it up to Barr. He totally mischaracterizes what's in there to the point that even Mueller's had enough. And then, of course, Garland appoints her, who I will get to in my outrage. And he, in total contradiction to policy, anything, issues this report. Garland, signs off on it. The report gets issued. Why do you think that Washington always wants a Republican special counsel? Are there any Democratic lawyers who are capable of doing this?
Oh, there are tons of Democratic lawyers who are capable of doing this. I mean, virtually every Democratic lawyer who's served in an inspector general position at any point would be eminently capable of doing this. Virtually any experienced criminal prosecutor who's a Democrat, who'd been a Democratic appointee to a U.S. attorney's office would be capable of doing this. I think it is just a difference between a party that cares about appearance and a party that doesn't care about appearance at all.
Well, okay, so appearance is important. So you appear better if you allow them to investigate themselves, or you appear better if you allow them to investigate your side. All respect, that's the logic that we're in now, and it strikes me is ludicrous
one of the things that Justice Scalia said when he dissented from the opinion in which the Supreme Court upheld the independent counsel, which is different than the special counsel, is he said, look, one of the things that is there is a natural inclination on the part of these folks to keep going and to dig in various ways because this is all they've got. Right. An average prosecutor has to think, is this the best case for me to be working on? Are there other cases that are better? And, you know, the special counsel just has every incentive to do what Rob Hur did. And, you know, I mean, the idea that they appointed somebody who had been the principal deputy to the deputy attorney general during a Republican administration, and they didn't expect that they would see at least some skewing in the report strikes me as naive.
Just so you know, my personal favorite is always the Durham report.
It gives new meaning to the phrase "bull Durham."
We were told that he was a principled prosecutor and that he would be ultimately fair. I thank you so much, Prof. Back to you, Alex.
You know, I go back so many years, and this guy later became our lawyer, but back when Ed Meese, when a special counsel was appointed to look at Ed Meese, it was Jake Stein, a great Washington lawyer, who spent, I think, Pam, about 2 months, and basically his report said, this guy is sleazy, but there's nothing indictable here. I mean, and it took I think even 7 or 8 weeks. There's no reason that her. I mean, I don't know. Jack Smith had a similar case, and it took him a matter of a couple months, right? I agree with James. It's outrageous. Listen, but you,
Jack Smith is not a he's not. Is he an independent counsel or is he just?
Well, he's a special counsel because he came back from the Criminal Court to do this. But he was a career DOJ lawyer. He was not a political appointee in his prior life. And, you know, I mean, I will say one thing, having spent time at the Justice Department, the career people at the Justice Department have a great deal of integrity.
Right.
And they're not going to skew things in a political direction in the way that, you know, as a political appointee, you are there to do the work that your president wants done. And that's just a very different kind of job.
Listen, Pam Carlin, please go back and have a great meal in Florence, Italy.
And
thank you so much for taking
it. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you so much, Bob. Thank you, Bob. We love you so much.
Sono contentissima di vedere.
Oh, my God. We could go on for another half hour. Hey, Pam, thanks. We'll talk soon.
Okie doke. Take care.
Bye. All right, and now for the outrages of the week. Boy, do we have a lot to choose from, Mr. Carville. Now that the National Football League is over, I've watched all 58 Super Bowls, by the way, and this is one of the best ever. I'm looking for new games. I got one. The Trump SS, as in stupid suck-ups, intentionally redundant. Much of the Republican Party is in contention, but a few still stand out. I apologize to Tim Scott and others who were in the finals but didn't quite make it. Lindsey Graham was with John McCain once, a stalwart hawk in Russia. McCain once called that a gas station masquerading as a country. But for Lindsey, or Squiggly T. Biscuit, as Christopher Buckley calls him, it would be John Who, as he takes his orders now from Commandant Trump. The latest embarrassment was the South Carolinian voting against the much-needed aid package to Ukraine in his struggle to fend off Russia's invasion. He said he wasn't bothered by Trump's charge that if a NATO country didn't meet his defense targets, he would encourage Putin to attack them. Now, some of the other senators, you know, this vote could have been out of ignorance. Tommy Tuberville, for example, couldn't spell NATO. But Lindsey Graham knows better, but it's more important for him to please the Don. But the front runner, I think Lindsey is only really a second place. The front runner in the Trump SS contest is New York Rep. Elise Stefanik, who this week filed an ethics complaint against the New York Attorney General for having the audacity to bring a fraud charge against Donald Trump. Can you imagine Donald Trump committing fraud? Now, it gets worse. As she pants and panders to be the Don's running mate, she declared if she had been Mike Pence on January the 6th, she would not have followed the law. She would not have routinely counted the electoral votes as required by the Constitution. She would have tried to enable a Trump coup instead. Greg Jacob, who worked with Stefanik in the Bush White House and, quote, enthusiastically, end quote, contributed to her first congressional campaign, thinking she was a thoughtful, principled conservative, was appalled. No one, he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, who espouses such lawless views should hold any position of authority. Absolutely. Although her views on the rule of law certainly do conform with Trump's.
So we're seeing two things currently. We're seeing that everybody's holding their breath and say, well, the Supreme Court decided immunity, and if they do, can we have the trial in May? But if it puts off to September, then if Trump wins, can we put it off? And it happened January 6th of 2021. Of course, our great attorney general, who we were all assured was a principled person who was going to restore integrity to the Justice Department, decided that he didn't want to investigate January 6th. Because he thought it would look too political. Imagine being political by investigating the most massive crime against the Constitution since Fort Sumter. But he didn't. And thank God we had politicians that came in. And politicians held hearings. And, of course, the hearings exposed criminality, of which our distinguished Cosmos Club, established libertarianism, judicious, thoughtful attorney general had no other choice but to start an investigation a long time after these criminal acts were committed. And so now, thanks to our attorney general, we're up against the clock. At the same week, we get the Per report, who was, by the way, appointed by our distinguished establishmentarianism, highly credentialed attorney general, a gentleman by the name of Robert Hur. What could be possibly wrong with a man named Robert Hur? I mean, well, he worked at Kirkland & Ellis under Brett Kavanaugh. He was a clerk for William Rehnquist, who, if you recall, was one of the most famous, whose career started as a vote suppressor, intimidating Hispanic voters in Arizona. And so then, and Mr. Herr, of course, is in the Federalist Society. So we could all be assured that the integrity of the Justice Department was going to be upheld. So he issues a report, which is totally contrary to Justice Department policy, of which, of course, Robert Mueller, another Republican, because there can be no other special counsels but Republican special counsels, because that is the law of Washington. It is chiseled in marble. And it has been validated through the years that only Republicans can investigate Republicans and only Republicans can investigate Democrats because, well, it will make them happy. Well, I hope you're happy now. I hope you had every kind of gratuitous piece of shit that you had. You waited until your hand was forced to investigate one of the most massive criminal acts in modern American history. You appointed a political zealot to investigate the President of the United States. Good work, Merrick. Maybe if somebody appoints you to the Supreme Court again, Mitch McConnell will be nice to you, because that's all you care about is what Republicans think about.
All right, James, now for our listener questions. Jim in Daniel Island, South Carolina, says, am I cynical, he asks, or is there a 100% chance that some Republican congressmen and senators are taking money from Russia? How big a role does foreign money play in our politics? James, I know that you are shocked.
Well, no telling how many, you know, remember Moscow Mitch, you know, how many outlets the Republicans have that are funding them, but and Trump, who takes it directly from Russia. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And, you know, Putin's got to be laughing himself silly on the gullibility of the Republican Party and the gullibility of the American people to think there's something remotely legit about this entire thing. I think the evidence abounds. You know, you only had to look. By the way, one of the most underreported, underappreciated documents, and probably it was bipartisan, so we can all be happy about that, was the Senate Intelligence Committee, which said there was Russian interference everywhere.
And the Trump was
helped. And for somehow or another, that never got the exposure that it should have. And if we have to learn that if you love America, you stop appeasing these bastards. But we just keep appeasing them, and we keep thinking that they'll do the right thing, that they'll be principled, that they're really Americans first and Republicans second. Oh, bullshit. Total bullshit.
Jay in Columbia, South Carolina. Boy, we're in a Palmetto State mode right today.
There we go. That's a cool state.
He says debates between candidates is a political expectation. Yet with two faltering men showing little appetite for them, what is the likelihood of a debate between Biden and Trump? Trump actually has already challenged Biden to debates because he thinks he is faltering. Have political debates exceeded their shelf life? What could take their place? Well, I certainly think the presidential debate, the Commission on Presidential Debates has outlived its usefulness probably several cycles ago. There's going to be something. I don't know what it is. One of the networks may come up with some kind of a deal and promise to have certain people on, not ask certain questions. I don't think it'll matter much. I don't think most debates actually mattered much, presidential debates. But, you know, this is one I'm not really going to eagerly anticipate a Biden-Trump debate.
Of course, as part of my example, the chairman of the Presidential Debate Commission would be none other than Frank Fahrenkopf, who, you guessed it, was the former chairman of the Republican Party. But so we can all be assured. And he's also a lobbyist for the gaming industry. In case you don't know what the gaming industry is, it's a fancy word for the casinos and the gambling and the books and in the gambling industry, all right? And, of course, the very distinguished commission in 2008 doesn't put the debate in New Orleans. They put it in Mississippi because Mississippi has casino gambling and they cut a backdoor whorehouse deal. But let's be assured that in the event that Mr. this thing is still existing, Ms. Farenkov resigns, the calls will be immediate to have another Republican as chairman, because there's no way that a Democrat could be have that kind of competence or that kind of fairness. It's just another bullshit example of where we are. I never thought the thing was worth a shit at the beginning. And of course, Biden's not going to debate. He can't answer the Super Bowl question. So in I don't know if we're better. I think we're probably better off not even having a debate.
James, we got a lot of bovine manure in this this segment here.
Sure do, because there's a lot of bovine manure that's
Chris
coming out of Washington.
In West Chicago, Illinois, he said nothing seems to be working for Biden to raise his poll numbers. So it seems high time for the Biden campaign to get into the pigsty with Trump. They need to find the Democratic Lee Atwater. You agree, James? And who would be a worthy successor to Lee?
Well, hey. Right. Biden is just, he's not a great counterpuncher. Let's leave it at that. And there's plenty of things, there are plenty of people who will do what I refer to as the wet work. All right. And wet work is a CIA term for assassinations. I'm not talking about assassinating anybody, so sit down and shut the fuck up. But I'm talking about going after Trump again and again and again, which is important. If I had a piece of advice in the messaging of to the Biden campaign, I'll go thusly. I get seven calls a week. Is the economy stupid? And why isn't Biden doing better? Because everybody says the economy is doing better. In everything has to do with what people call cost of living, not inflation. Don't use the inflation word. And they say correctly, so you come in the office and a gallon of gas costs $2.50 and gas goes to $4 and it's back to $3.25. And you're trying to argue with people that, well, it's 75% cheaper than it was a year ago, but it's 75% more expensive than it was when you took office. And who do people think is behind this? I'll tell you exactly who they think. They think these companies are you price gouging, that they're fixing prices. And you know what? Maybe the public is right. Maybe the public has a point. Maybe the public doesn't suck so much. So if I were the president, I would say, I understand that, you know, we're fighting this. We feel like we've made some progress on some fronts. There's still more progress to be made. That's why we brought the cost of insulin down to help families deal with this. That's why we can negotiate drug prices. That's why we released the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to help try to get families deal with the high cost of gasoline. And to further our efforts in helping American families to deal with this, I have asked Merrick Garland, because he's too goddamn weak to do anything, to appoint a special counsel to investigate price fixing, price gouging, price anything you can think of that corporate America and energy companies are doing to screw the American consumer. And I expect a report on my desk in this within 4 months. If you do that, you're showing people you're on their side, that you understand what they're going through, and you understand who the real culprit is. Because people tell focus group after focus group after focus group after focus group, they come back with the same thing. It's not particularly complimentary to Biden. Be frank, well, Biden, he's too old to really cause inflation. What's really causing it are these companies are colluding on prices, and he can't do anything to stop them. And if you want to talk about the economy in a positive way and let people know that you know what's going on in their lives, stop telling them that their lives are great and start telling them how you're going to make their lives better.
Makes sense to me. Annie in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Who do the Democrats have ready if Biden can't run or bows out and something fatal happens to him? Annie, how do I count the numbers? There are so many, and I think you first look outside of Washington. Governors, Gretchen Whitmer, Gavin Newsom, Roy Cooper, newcomers who were so good they would even be ready for prime time quickly. Josh Shapiro, Wes Moore. There's so much talent out there. It's not going to happen, Annie. It's not going to happen. He is going to stay in, and Harris is going to stay in, and what you're going to have to do, Annie, is just say, okay, I'm not happy with this, But is it better than having a criminal in the White House? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah. There's no secret. Not that I'd want to deny it, or you would, anybody that this show has been one of the most skeptical. Two things that this show has been really consistently. It's been vehemently anti-Trump from its inception. And it has also been highly skeptical, it's a polite word I want to use, of Biden running for re-election. We are apparently, although I said earlier, I don't think Biden or Trump will be on the ballot in November. I will admit that seems unlikely, maybe highly unlikely. I still don't think it's impossible. There's just a lot left to go here. And one of the things that I find is that no one just appreciates how bad these numbers are. And you say, well, James, we had Fred Yang and we had Jim Gerstein on, and they're loyal, they got clients, and they're tremendous guests. And you got to understand that, back in your day, it was common for politicians to be over 50. That's kind of a thing of the past, which is true. And then the president's people say, well, James, you got to understand, the president's approvals are low, but we're getting more somewhat disapprove to vote for us than you would expect back in your payday. Okay, true. So the latest Hart poll, so I just want to be clear, which there's any gold standard in polling, is the Hart Research people, and I think it's highly justifiable that they have this reputation, showed that Biden had a disapproval of 60. That's terrible, but maybe that we can get the soft disapprove, somewhat disapprove voters. The strong disapproval was 49. The somewhat disapproved was 11. That's not a good ratio. That's not a good ratio. That's not good at all. It's bad. It's historically bad. And somebody should have pointed out, as opposed to just posting the number and putting it in the frequency questionnaire and having people have to, like I have to do, and go dig it out, why don't somebody do presidential strong disapproval by history? But, I think we're going through with this, and I don't think people have sufficient information of just how daunting this general election is.
Well, James, here's how you can help them. Abby in Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania, that's near the area, that's my home country. She says, I'm interested in making effective political contributions for state-level candidates. Do you think it's best to donate to organizations such as the States Project, the local Democratic Party, or the candidates themselves? Also, what organizations do you recommend that focus on getting out the vote?
That's less in my wheelhouse. I would go, we're going to do this. I promise y'all we're going to do this. And we always do tout the Wisconsin State Democratic Party because Ben Wickler is a tremendous friend of the show, but he's not a friend because we're doing him a favor. We're doing a friend because he's one of the best parties he has ever. The same thing is true in Virginia. I think the same thing is true in Michigan. Not so much true in Pennsylvania. Not so much true in Nevada. But we need to get someone who really knows these state parties, and let's give people, the top five most critical state parties they are. And so they can do that. Another project, and I want to see if somebody does this. I get a lot of people that want to help, but that they can't travel, they got to work from home, they have jobs, they're elderly, or they whatever. We got to get somebody that puts out lists of voters who don't, not habitual voters, but likely Democratic voters, and give this list to people who want to volunteer and have them write handwritten postcards. I think these things can work. I think this kind of stuff, it's not going to switch any election around, but if we can send 100,000 postcards to non-habitual likely Democratic voters in Georgia or North Carolina or somewhere else, I think we can make an effect. And I think people, there are a lot of people who love their country that would participate in a project like this. So I'm going to try to do some research and see if anything like this exists or anything like this is possible. Because I just get too many people that want to do something. And, you know, he said, well, if somebody in California says, James, what can I do? I said, well, you can move to Arizona. And they kind of giggle. I said, well, that's kind of hard. I got kids in school and can't do that. And so we're going to work on some good places where you can effectively send a check, because I think that's important to people. I think it's an act of political hygiene to do that. And I'm going to try to work through a system if we see we can get people a list of names and start writing postcards.
Okay, Abby, we're going to stay on this. James is going to stay on this. And I want everybody else to write down that we have to get back to this. We're going to get back to you, Abby. Thanks for the very good question. The next is from Liz in New York City, who says, why do you think senators like Romney, Tillis, and a few of the others who are vocal about how fed up they are with MAGA, the MAGA takeover, why don't they switch to independent? They can vote what they believe and help pass bills like aid for Ukraine and the border bill. Liz, first of all, Romney's retiring because he can't take it. The others, they could switch to independent and they get beaten then in the general election. MAGA people would nominate a Republican. Most Republicans would vote for that person. Most Democrats would vote for the Democrat. And that person is going to be, in the middle of the highway, which is not a good place to be. I wish it weren't so, but I'm afraid it is.
Yeah, I concur in your answer. They get all kinds of stuff through the party, donations, they get a lot of base of voters. Associated with a political party gives you, a base of voters, gives you resources, gives you think structure, gives you a lot. And to walk away from that is pretty significant stuff. It's easier to say you're an independent than to actually be an independent.
Right. Sure is. James, the final question is, I'm going to combine two because they're almost identical. Jeff in St. Pete Beach, Florida, says, it seems like Biden's no longer has the public communication skills and capabilities to take on Trump. I think this is something you've worried about. And Joni in Amherst, Massachusetts, wonders why he hasn't taken advantage of the presidency to talk directly and often to the public about what he's accomplished. Fireside chats seem like a slam dunk. What am I missing?
All right. So here we go, people. It's time for our little group here to have a frank discussion. He can't. And again, to me, one of the most significant things just happened in a political campaign was Biden opting out of the Super Bowl interview. And believe it or not, I kind of agree with him. And they made the conclusion that the risk, that the benefit would be this, the risk would be that. Like most people that make an evaluation, if you're going to buy a stock or buy a piece of land or buy something else, you say, well, this is the potential benefit. This is a political risk. When the risk is too high, you walk away from it. So we're going into this campaign and you have to look at a campaign like you look at anything else. I'm a big believer in this, a sports team, a military, a corporation. You have certain assets. All right, so you run a campaign. What are your assets? You have assets, you have base voters, you have fundraising, you have structure, you have staff, you have resources, you have research, you have advanced people, you got everything else. But generally, your most valuable asset that you possess is your candidate, because the candidate can go out and the press is not going to follow. The research director is not going to be on the 6 o'clock news. The research director is, however important she or he may be. The base voters are not going to be people that are going to be front and center, as important as may be. And we're going into a campaign where we say we're not going to use what in most campaigns is the most valuable asset. It's, if you work for a guy like Bill Clinton, it's simple. Something happens, just put the candidate out there. Shit, that don't take a whole lot of thinking. That's not what we face with. That's not what the Biden strategists are faced with. And I kind of defend them because it's very hard to run a campaign with the candidate AWOL 80% of the time, because they're not going to be debates. And, you know, of course, what he can do is he can do infrastructure events. He can do walking through the plant floor, talking to people kind of events. He still is very good at that. He's a very empathetic guy. It comes across. But there are not going to be any press conferences, not going to be any town halls. All right, you can't go and say, go there and go right into, you know, the enemy's territory, go in northern Wisconsin and ask me anything. That's not going to happen. You're not going to take these interviews. You're not going to do anything like that. You're not going to debate. And his strategists have a very difficult workaround here. And I have some sympathy for him.
Yeah, I do too. James, I'm going to close something different. Talk about a tough calculation, playing the odds. The 49ers coach, Kyle Shanahan, is getting a lot of criticism for, in the overtime, deciding to receive and give Kansas City a shot after he took a shot. You know, I understand his calculation. I very little experience with this. It's a new rule for the NFL. But, you know, it's almost 50-50. The argument the other way is, if Shanahan had decided to kick off and Kansas City scored and then San Francisco went down and scored, guess what happens next? Kansas City gets the ball, and if they score and they have Patrick Mahomes, they win. So either way, it's a tough, tough decision. I don't, you know, maybe it didn't work out, but I think it's unfair to criticize him for it.
I agree with your point. Unfair is just, you know, that just comes with the territory. So what happened was last year against Buffalo, Kansas City gets the ball first in overtime to kick a field goal. That's the end of the game. People rightly say this is bullshit. You shouldn't have a playoff game decided by a coin toss. Okay. Well, at this point, we're making a lot of sense. NFL, the reason why the NFL is what it is, you know, is they change the rules when you have to. You know, we watch basketball, Dean Smith's four corners offense, you know, or people are dominating the center. They put the paint, they put a lane, they made it wide, they put a shot clock in, all made the game better. They did all kinds of things in football to make it actually made it better. And I'll be honest with you, it's made it somewhat safer. Baseball, of course, the slowest to do, made changes, and it proved to be spectacularly successful. So the NFL decides that, you know, you get, if you score, another team gets a chance to score. Then if the score is tied, then you're at sudden death. I agree with Shanahan. And so the big decision is he decides to kick field goal. And if I know I'm getting the ball third, I'm stopping Kansas City pretty consistently. At this point, Kansas City, I think, had one touchdown.
Yeah, but you stopped them in the first half, not so much the second half.
Well, they were kicking field goals. All right? So the chances that you're going to stop them from a touchdown are pretty good. So if they kick a field goal, well, then you're in the catbird seat because you get another possession, and if you kick a field goal, the game is over. Now, what was confusing to a lot of people was they had a quarter clock. So you were watching, if you were watching the little thing on the bottom of the TV that we all do, it was third down and six, and it was 18 seconds left, which, of course, is meaningless. The quarter didn't make it. It was just going to change. There was no win. There was no reason to do that. It was just slightly confusing. And also, some of the San Francisco players said they didn't know the rules, which is pretty remarkable. But I think I agree with you. And I think if I were in the same position as Shanahan, I would have made the same choice. Now, we grew up, when we watch football, every time the team would choose to receive. Now, every time the team wants the ball to start the second half, when did that change? When did we go from 95% wanting the ball on opening the kickoff to 95% wanting the ball in the second half? I don't know. I can't remember when it happened, changed, but I know it happened over.
James, so, I would just add.
I would just add.
But I think there's all kinds of calculations and all kinds of algorithms and analysis. in any situation, I don't want to bet against Patrick Mahomes. He is up there now. He is creeping up on Tom Brady as maybe the greatest of all time. Not there yet, but man, he is something. And he's never better than when it counts.
Yeah, I mean, the field goal. I mean, look, I gave all credit to the MVP, but this was not the best game I've ever seen midway through the fourth quarter. For the rest of the time, it was as good a game as I've ever seen. But I
think what got underrated is these are two tough defenses. These are really two tough defenses. Right. I mean, this was not just, you know, the offense is not working. Man, it was tough. But
the other side drops.
In any event, okay, we'll continue this. And you all, thanks for listening. Keep those questions coming in, and we're going to answer that question that about what to do and where to go to help your candidates. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville. I'm Al Hunt. And don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicom. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, ZBiotics, Beam, and Real Paper, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, keep up with us. Subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel, or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.